What we've experienced for the past 9,000 years is the exception. It's not the norm. The norm is climate instability. That's kind of a jumping off point for people to understand, well, how do we get this climate stability and what can we do to preserve it?
This is The Butterfly Effect, a podcast that shows the big impact a small action can do. Tali Orad is talking to those special people that make a difference with nature and trees.
Welcome everyone to The Butterfly Effect. My name is Tali Orad. I'm your host and your butterfly here. My special guest today is astronomer Dr. Hugh Ross. Dr. Ross is founder and president of Reasons to Believe. He is also the author of Weathering Climate Change. Welcome, Ross, to The Butterfly Effect.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
So you're an astronomer, which is a scientist who studies the universe.
Yes, my specialty was quasars and galaxies.
So what is the connection between galaxies and climate change?
Well, I got interested in climate change just because I'm interested in the history of the Earth, and I realized a lot of people thought that climate stability was a norm. And so just sharing with them the history of the solar system, that what we've experienced for the past 9,000 years is the exception. It's not the norm. Mm-hmm. The norm is climate instability. That's kind of a jumping off point for people to understand, well, how do we get this climate stability and what can we do to preserve it?
Okay, so you mentioned climate stability and climate instability. Can you explain a little bit?
For the past 2.6 million years, we've been in an ice age cycle where our planet cycles between 10% coverage of ice to about 23% coverage. Mm-hmm. And it's that ice age cycle that drives extreme climate instability, where the global mean temperature will jump up and down by 8 to 10 degrees centigrade on timescales of just centuries. The exception to that is the past 9,500 years.
You mentioned now the ice age cycle.
Yes.
Why is that so important? Why do we still need to have it? What's wrong with having a stable climate? We can live on that, right?
Right. For most of Earth's history, there hasn't been an ice age cycle driving our climate. But there's some benefits we get for living during an ice age cycle. Because as we come out of an ice age and go into an interglacial, you get two major fertilization events. You get these high winds blowing off the plateaus that have recently had ice, dumping nutrient-rich dust onto the low-lying plains where we grow all our food. Mm-hmm. Also, as the ice rapidly melts from the continental land masses, it causes a rebound. All that weight is lifted off the continents, so the continents literally rebound, and that ignites volcanic eruptions all around the world. At the close of the last ice age, we had all these volcanic eruptions, and that too resulted in rich nutrients being deposited upon the plains where we grow our food. And then the second big benefit we get is the melting ice. Even today, most of the water we have for our agricultural plains comes from the melting of ice left over from the last ice age. And so if it wasn't for that melting ice, and if it wasn't for these fertilization events, we would not be able to grow enough food to feed billions of human beings.
So basically what you're saying is that in a way, when we don't get to an ice age, we get to a point where we exhaust all resources, right? And need in some way to restart and get to that ice age.
Right. Because if we extend the interglacial too long, we will run out of ice.
And then what? What's wrong with that?
Well, what's wrong with that is we're going to have to find another source of water. And people have been thinking, well, maybe we can desalinate water from the oceans. Mm-hmm. But that's expensive. And you got to find the energy to make that happen. Yes, it'd be good if we could, you know, slow down the melting of ice. Mm-hmm. And this is particularly a problem in the Tibetan Plateau. The 20 biggest rivers in Asia flow out of the Tibetan Plateau. And what's feeding them is the melting of ice on the Himalayas and the Tibetan Plateau. A lot of people don't realize there's actually more ice there than there is in the Arctic Ocean.
That's very interesting. Basically, what you're saying is that rising temperature melts all the ice, and we are not getting into ice age, and we are exhausting all the resources, so we'll run out of water and the ability to grow crops and feed ourselves and all those things.
Yes. Well, I could put it this way. What we see in the ice age cycle is that global warming beyond where we are right now always brings on global cooling.
Mm-hmm.
We actually have an understanding why. If you melt the winter polar ice cap, that means that you're going to have sunlight being absorbed much more efficiently. Right now, over the Arctic Ocean, sunlight is reflected with about 60% efficiency.
Mm-hmm.
But if you melt that ice, it's now only reflected with about 6% efficiency. All that extra solar heat being absorbed by the Arctic Ocean produces water vapor, and that water vapor falls as snow on Canada and Siberia. And the only reason why Canada and Siberia are not covered by thousands of feet of ice today, there simply isn't enough snowfall.
Yeah.
They're virtual deserts. But if you melt the polar ice cap, and the key thing is melting the winter polar ice cap. Because if you melt the summer polar ice cap, you get rain. But if you melt the winter polar ice cap, then you get snow falling on Siberia and Canada. And certainly we've seen a lot of loss in the summer cap, but it's a winter cap we really need to pay attention to.
And then will that help us start or ignite the ice age process?
Yes, because if you double the snowfall over Canada and Siberia,
mm-hmm.
then that snow is going to accumulate year to year and it'll quickly build up a thick ice cap. And that's going to change the global climate, and that will quickly drive us into the next ice age. And ice ages typically last 90,000 years.
Can we live in an ice age?
We can, but not at the population level or the technology we have today. The population level would catastrophically drop, and it would certainly impact our technology, because every ice age, you have extreme climate instability.
Mm-hmm.
Means that even in the tropical areas, it's going to be difficult to predict which crops will succeed and which crops will fail.
And do you think there is a way for us to prepare for that? Because it seems like it's inevitable that it's coming. Maybe not tomorrow, but soon enough.
It's inevitable that it's going to happen. However, we can delay it. We have the potential of bringing on the next ice age within a few centuries. But we also have the potential of putting it off for 1,000 to 1,500 years. And I think it'd be nice to have the kind of climate stability we've been enjoying for the past 9,000 years to be extended, say, for another 1,000 years.
Yeah, I'm just thinking that will be amazing. On the other hand, when you think of let's find a way to postpone it, doesn't mean it will incentivize humanity to do something to prepare. Because when you think about it, if it's 20, 30 years, then people feel like they see it's if it's not them, it's their kids. If it's 1,000 years, everybody will think, well, that's not even close to my great, 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 great grandkids, right?
Right, right. However, in 1,000 years, we might be able to develop technology that'll help us to better weather, an ice age than what we're dealing with right now. But yeah, I mean, thermodynamics is the name of the universe. It happens. So,
right.
We shouldn't anticipate that we've had extremely optimal conditions for the past 9,000 years.
Right.
And it's simply unrealistic to expect that we can extend that indefinitely. I mean, after all, the sun's getting brighter and brighter as it continues to fuse hydrogen to helium.
Mm-hmm.
So one thing I put in my book, Weathering Climate Change, is if you look forward, say, 2 million years, we have some really bad things happening. There's no technology that's going to stop the sun from getting brighter. And you can compensate for it by pulling greenhouse gases out of the atmosphere. But the problem is photosynthetic life needs a minimum of 150 parts per million of carbon dioxide.
Mm-hmm.
And we got very close to that minimum during the last ice age. During the last ice age, photosynthesis stopped at high elevations. Mm-hmm. There simply wasn't enough carbon dioxide to sustain photosynthetic life.
So what can we do?
Well, on a time scale of 1,000 to 1,500 years, there are things we can do to continue to stabilize the climate that'll boost the world economy, rather cripple the world economy, mm-hmm. and simultaneously benefit the world's ecosystems. This should be a no-brainer to everybody. If right. everybody wins, we get a better economy. And particularly, I think the solutions I'm proposing are going to maximally benefit the poor. So we get to raise the living standards of the poor. We mm-hmm. benefit the rich. We improve the ecosystems. So it's a win-win all the way around. Why not do these things?
So tell me about those things.
Probably the most immediate thing that we could do that would bring an enormous benefit is stop burning coal and instead burn natural gas. Natural gas releases half the greenhouse gases in the atmosphere that burning coal does. Mm-hmm. Also, when you burn coal, you release carbon soot particles. For example, the Canadian Arctic is warming about five times faster than the rest of the world on average. And what they're recognizing is not so much the greenhouse gases, it's the black carbon soot. Mm-hmm. Black carbon soot from India and China is being wafted and being dumped on eastern Siberia and on Canada. That's something that could be done immediately, and mm-hmm. it could be done very economically. Yes, you're still burning fossil fuels, but you have an immediate impact on reducing greenhouse gases and eliminating black carbon soot.
And hopefully by that also transition to other energy like solar.
Well, I'm not too optimistic about wind or solar. I mean, wind, for example, it's got a high carbon cost to construct and maintain, and it kills birds. And
right.
You're dependent on variable wind velocities, so it's not that reliable. Solar requires carpeting a lot of our planet with panels, which is going to impact the ecosystems over those parts of the world. And it's not that cost effective. I think what has great hope is thorium nuclear power generation. It's going to take time, but that's where I think transferring from coal to natural gas could buy us a time to develop thorium nuclear power generation. Mm-hmm. And that thorium nuclear power, unlike uranium nuclear power, you have the toxic waste are safe to handle within 200 years, and in some cases, even 50 years, as opposed to 50,000 years. Mm-hmm. It's impossible to use thorium nuclear reactors to make nuclear weapons, which means we could give these nuclear power generating plants to nations that we worry about.
Right.
And also, it's impossible to have a meltdown. Workers don't have to wear gear to mine the thorium. And thorium is three times more abundant than uranium, and it generates 300 times the power per ton of uranium. Mm-hmm. So you're going to get a lot more bang for the buck, and you literally could produce all the energy the world needs from just that one source. Mm-hmm. I also think we could do a better job with managing our forests. I mean, because that's a major concern. Forests
yes.
store a lot of carbon. You've got people in Brazil, for example, saying, let's cut down the jungle and turn it into pasture land. And what they don't realize is the soils are not that nutrient rich. Mm-hmm. And yes, you'll be able to have cattle for a decade or two, and then you've got a desert.
Right. And not to mention the effects of cattle on the atmosphere. Yeah.
Exactly. It's going to pump more greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. And instead, you're better off doing what I call selective lumbering. Where you go into the jungle, you don't clear cut, but you selectively cut out the big old trees that are in danger of dying. Those trees, if they die, release huge amounts of greenhouse gases to the atmosphere. Mm-hmm. But if you harvest them before they start decaying, number one, you make the most money out of the biggest trees. And you can sequester that wood as furniture and homes for centuries. Then you replace those big trees that you cut down with young trees. Mm-hmm. And trees at a certain age will pull greenhouse gases out of the atmosphere at up to four times the rate that old trees will. And so this idea of preserving a forest where we don't cut down anything is actually counterproductive. We'd be better off selectively harvesting the trees, not clear-cutting, but right. selectively harvesting, replanting, making sure the trees are not too dense, because if they're too dense, the bark beetles will go in and kill the trees. And the bottom line is you can make a lot of money from lumbering if you lumber that way as opposed to clear-cutting. The wildlife is going to do a lot better, and you're going to be doubling the amount of greenhouse gases you're pulling out of the atmosphere.
Right. So I have a question on that. When you cut down a tree, if it decays, whatever it absorbed throughout the years goes back to the atmosphere. So preserving it and doing something with it is better. However, right. when I'm thinking of repurposing it for, let's say, furniture, right? Mm-hmm. Or lumber for building materials.
Building material, right.
Yes. That requires shipment.
Yes.
And it goes out of the country, which is another issue with carbon being released to the atmosphere by all. I mean, you get in a way the same emission. On the other hand, you can just maybe shred that old tree and use it for composting and try to restore different areas of land.
Well, it's important to allow some of the trees to die because that's crucial for the ecosystem.
Right.
The point is we would be wise to harvest some of them.
I do agree that harvesting is the right way because you know they're going to die.
Yeah, if they die, it's going to cause a problem. They're going to release
course.
Greenhouse gases to the atmosphere. But you need to let a few of them die.
Right. I'm just asking if you think there is another alternative than repurposing them, but with the process of shipping them, once we ship them, then we do damage on the other
side. If you do it with all the force in the world, then you cut down the shipping costs. So, for example, I'm arguing that we should stop protecting our national parks. Right now, you're not allowed to lumber in any of the national parks. But in the United States, I've been to some national parks where a third of the trees are dead or dying.
Right.
The wildlife suffers as a result. We'd be far better off selectively harvesting that timber. And that way, the wildlife would benefit. The mm-hmm. forests look a lot more beautiful for the tourists, and you'd be releasing a whole lot less greenhouse gases from the atmosphere, and you'd also be stimulating the local economy.
Right.
Now, you're right. Instead of shipping furniture overseas, you basically produce the furniture from the forests that are local, and so that's going to cut down greenhouse gas emission.
Mm-hmm. So we talked about two. We talked about trees, and we talked about nuclear.
Yeah, what I have in my book is about 40 different ventures that we can undertake that would be these kinds of win-win solutions. You were mentioning earlier our dependence upon cattle. Mm-hmm. And the cattle release a lot of methane and carbon dioxide to the atmosphere. Moreover, the meat that we get from beef, for example, is not all that healthy. Yes, it's iron rich, but it's also loaded with a lot of fats that are not good for our health. How about if we were to try to get a red meat from ostriches instead of from beef cattle?
Mm-hmm.
Ostriches release only 2% of the greenhouse gases per pound of meat that you would get from beef. So that'd be a huge, when you just think of how much of the human diet is dependent upon cattle,
right.
If we can replace that with a red meat source that releases only 2% of the greenhouse gases, we'd be way ahead. Moreover, if we scale up the production of ostrich meat, we can actually drive the cost down below that of turkey, which is currently the cheapest form of meat on the market.
Mm-hmm.
So it means that it'd be much cheaper than beef. It'd be red meat, tasted ostrich meat. It tastes just as good as beef. It's very low in cholesterol and saturated fats.
Mm-hmm.
It's literally the healthiest meat that you can eat. So it's going to be good for your health, it's going to be cheap to raise, and you release only 2% of the greenhouse gases. There is one downside, however. You cannot treat ostriches like you do cows. Cows you can release into a huge pasture and just ignore them. They
mm-hmm.
don't need human contact. But ostriches are highly social animals. They need contact with one another. They love contact with humans.
Right.
If you raise them the right way, This could be a huge economic boost to the diet and nutrition of the world. It'd be a cheap source of food and a greenhouse gas emission. Mm-hmm. You don't need a lot of land for raising ostriches. So instead of having these huge ranches, you could have much smaller ranches, which means you could have bigger forests than we have on the planet today.
Yeah, that's actually great to have less land use for livestock and repurpose them and plant trees.
Well, like with ostriches, you could cut that down to 10% of what we're using right now. I mean, so it's an enormous effect.
Yes, yes. And can they live in any climate?
Well, they can't live, say, in the Canadian North, but they can live anywhere in the contiguous United States, mm-hmm. almost anywhere in Europe. So yeah, they are capable. I mean, you see them in zoos around the world, so they don't have to be living in the tropics.
What else?
You know, I argue in the book that restoring the whale populations is one of the best things we could do for our economy and one of the best things we can do for the ocean ecosystem. And also, you'd be drawing down huge quantities of greenhouse gases. Mm-hmm. Whales are big animals. They breathe carbon dioxide. The unique thing about whales is that they defecate soluble iron minerals on the surface of the ocean. And what that does is it fertilizes the phytoplankton, increased by 50%. And of course, that would feed the zooplankton. The zooplankton feeds the fish. Mm-hmm. The fish feed the big animals. They found out that by bringing back the sperm whale population, that the sizes and the populations of giant squid went up. Mm-hmm. And that was an enigma, because the only predator for giant squid are sperm whales. So now we got more sperm whales, but we also have more giant squid, and the giant squid are bigger. And what they determined was it was the sperm whales feed on these giant squid, which are very iron rich, but these sperm whales never defecate at depth. They only defecate on the surface. And what they defecate is soluble iron. And this fertilizes the phytoplankton, which feeds the zooplankton, which feeds the fish, which feeds the big fish that these giant squid feed on. So the giant squid have actually got more food. And because they got more food, their population goes up, their sizes goes up. So as an example, we're literally the entire ocean ecosystem benefits from restoring the sperm whale population.
Usually when you change the balance, bad things that we did not expect happens. Here you gave an example which actually showed that when you do that, it helped also the squids. But I fear there is something we may miss because we try to focus on something. Let's just do the whales.
Right.
Do you think that this is something that nature can correct on its own?
Well, it's we humans that nearly wiped out the whales during the whaling industry that happened after the Industrial Revolution. And the problem there is whales are highly social. They really love human contact. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so instead of running away from the whaling ships, they would swim towards them. And we almost wiped them out as a result. But if we were to bring the whale population back to where they were 300 years ago, we would literally be restoring the ocean ecosystem.
Right.
In that sense, we're basically saying that's the way nature was before we messed it up. Well, experiments have already been done on the sperm whales and on the baleen whales that demonstrate, hey, increasing the whale populations will indeed be a win-win. Mm-hmm. And that's going to increase the fish stocks of the world, because that's a major concern. We're over-harvesting the oceans.
Right.
So if we can bring the fish stocks back, that means more nutritious food for the human population. And we got the whales back to where they were 300 years ago. That would pull huge amounts of greenhouse gases out of the atmosphere, because we're increasing the phytoplankton population. Mm-hmm. And phytoplankton are the, by themselves, they account for about 60% of photosynthetic activity on the planet. And so that 60% means a lot more greenhouse gases, carbon dioxide in particular, being pulled out of the atmosphere.
Right. Now, in your book, you also talk about the Sahara Desert expanding due to stripping vegetation on its edge. Why is it so important to maintain?
Well, the Sahara Desert right now is about 10 times bigger than it was 2,000 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And so the question is, how did the Sahara Desert get that big?
Mm-hmm.
And what's been discovered is it's people living on the edge of the desert that harvest vegetation, typically shrubs, mm-hmm. and use those shrubs for cooking fuel and for heating their domiciles. Earlier in the 20th century, the Sahara Desert was growing at a rate of 6 miles per year southward mm-hmm. because of the degree to which those peoples were stripping the land of vegetation. What if we were to go to them and say, we will give you all the kerosene you want for free. You can use it any way you want on the condition you work with us to replant the Sahara and Gobi deserts.
Mm-hmm.
And the Israelis have already showed us you can literally restore the desert in about one generation. So it can be done fairly quickly.
Right.
And if we were to do that, the Sahara Desert would now become an income source for those people.
Mm-hmm.
They'd be able to grow crops there, where today they can't grow anything, and they can sell those crops. Moreover, the wildlife would be restored to that region.
Mm-hmm.
So you restore the ecosystem, you generate an economic source of income, and you're pulling greenhouse gases out of the atmosphere.
Right. All the examples, which are mostly something that governments need to do, administrations need to do. What can the regular person do?
I'm arguing that if we give people a strong enough economic incentive, the governments won't have to do anything except get out of the way. and economists tell us, if you can show people that they can get more than a 7% return per annum on their mm-hmm. investment,
mm-hmm.
you don't have to pass any laws. So for example, what if the national parks agencies basically told the local lumbering companies, you can come into our national forests and national parks, but we want you to harvest in a way that's going to benefit the national parks and the ecosystems there, but also make you more money than you would make if you were just a clear cut.
Right.
I think the lumbering companies would say, wow, what a generous offer. Thank you.
Do we have any hope of impacting or slowing climate change? What do you think?
Yeah, I'm very hopeful. Where I'm pessimistic is if we insist on trying to persuade people to make huge economic sacrifices in order to stabilize the climate, I do agree with my climatologist friends that would work, but I don't think we're going to be able to motivate people to make those kinds of economic sacrifices. And if we have the government force people to do it, that's going to make for even more political unrest than we've got right now. I'm arguing that if we want to stabilize the climate and stabilize the climate quickly, then we have to give people an economic incentive. An economic sacrifice means that people are going to dig in their heels. They're going to do everything they can delay it. And I do agree with my climatologist friends that delay is not an option. If we are delay another 20 years, we're going to be moving quickly to extreme climate instability and the onset of the next ice age. So I'm persuaded the only way we're going to stabilize the climate is through economic incentives.
Which sounds not as hard as people think. What is your favorite tree, by the way?
My favorite tree is a larch tree. I was born, raised, and educated in Canada.
Mm-hmm.
And when you get to high altitudes or cold parts of Canada, you get these beautiful larch trees. They're a conifer, but they produce these feathery needles. And the color, there's a green color you see there. And it's the only conifer that loses its leaves in winter. And so you get a changing of the color. It goes from a beautiful green to a bright gold in the fall. And I also love the way that birds like to congregate in those trees. So yeah, the larch has always been my favorite tree.
This is beautiful. Thank you so much, you, for joining me today and for giving us hope and suggestions to actually make change.
Well, if people are interested, they can get a free chapter of my book.
Perfect.
And they'll get a little taste of some of these economic incentives.
Perfect. So please, I encourage you guys to do it. So thank you so much.
You're very welcome. My pleasure.
And thank you, everyone, for joining me today. We are all beautiful butterflies, each in his and her individual ways. I wanted to thank you for joining me today in this episode. I really appreciate you coming on this journey with me, and I hope you can join me next time. And remember, it only takes a small action to make a big difference. Be a butterfly.
And that's all for this episode. Thank you for joining us today. Please subscribe to hear more of our stories of change.